This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, the midterm election is almost here, and one undecided first-time voter has little faith in business as usual.
This is me being a little bit of an idealist, but I do hope that eventually the two-party system is eliminated. It's so divided.
Also coming up this week, a new report on climate change has been unveiled. An Illinois state climatologist will weigh in on it. What happened on a Springfield school bus between a teacher and a student? We'll examine that case. We'll also look back at why the state controller and treasurer offices in Illinois are separate. The decision can be traced to a scandal that happened more than a half century ago.
If you don't have good accounting control set up, you know, darker angels might rear their head.
And we'll visit with a farmer who's been working the fields for more than 70 years. All that and more coming up on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, we'll hear from a first-time voter getting ready to cast a ballot this fall. What does she think about the state of politics? And what happened on a Springfield school bus between a teacher and a student? Our education reporter Dusty Rhodes will delve into that story. That and more coming up on Statewide. We begin today with the races for controller and treasurer in Illinois, not usually the most high-profile statewide offices. Even during the campaigns, these positions rarely get much attention. In fact, their very existence usually comes into question in proposals to merge the offices into one. Years ago, one person was in charge. And for Illinois issues this week, Sam Dunklaw tells us how that all changed.
Let's go back to 1970. Illinois was in the midst of a constitutional convention, and delegates from across the state were rewriting the rules of state government. It hadn't been done in nearly a century. There was special focus on who would handle state finances. That's because Illinois had recently been robbed blind. The story behind why Illinois has a separate state treasurer and comptroller office is one filled with fast moves, fancy cars, and fraud.
They were dealing with the history that involved massive embezzlement by one of the elected auditors of public accounts, Orville Hodge.
That's political science professor Kent Redfield. He's a leading expert on Illinois government and its history. He mentioned a name that's crucial to all of this, Orville Enoch Hodge, who held the now abolished auditor of public accounts office between 1952 and 56. In just 4 years, he stole an estimated $6 million taxpayer dollars, about $56 million in today's money.
It was one of the early big public scandals because we had this run of public scandals from sort of 1970 on, with all these governors going to jail.
That's Chris Mooney talking there, a political science professor at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He and Kent Redfield agree. Illinois has two offices for money handling because Orville Hodge proved one person couldn't be trusted. Hodge was raised in Granite City. Before getting into state politics, he inherited a business from his father and was a financial success. He was personable and outgoing, once called a golden boy of the Illinois GOP. Many were stunned to learn a man that had so much had stolen so much. Here's how he did it. As the auditor of public accounts, almost every dime Illinois government spent went through Hodge. He would check to see if the expense was legal, write a check, and mail them out. Except a lot of those checks were written out to him. The president of a friendly bank in Chicago would personally deposit the cash into a secret account. Once he had the money, Hodge spent it on more than 24 luxury cars and 2 private jets. He bought pricey real estate in Illinois and Florida and threw extravagant parties for Springfield insiders. To keep the legislature off his trail, Hodge handed out jobs and fudged his accounting records, which, as Chris Mooney reminds us, is a big problem.
If you don't have good accounting control set up, the darker angels might rear their heads. Or, you want to make it hard on people. You want to make it difficult for them to do bad.
But it wasn't difficult to do bad. And that's the really mind-boggling thing about Hodge's crimes. They were par for the course in Illinois. Pilfering of the state treasury, payroll padding, and other graft was going on all the time. But the scale at which Hodge was able to do it made him unique. Good old Orv, as he was called, was eventually found out. Illinois investigated for decades to come up with a final accounting of Hodge's theft. Kent Redfield says the scandal left uneasiness in its wake.
There was a concern about, who audits the auditor and how do we get better fiscal control.
So when the Auditor of Public Accounts Office was brought up at the 1970 Constitutional Convention, the state just got rid of it altogether.
You know, and that led to these two offices, one being basically the one that has the checkbook and the other one that invests the money.
That checkbook handler Chris Mooney is talking about is called the Comptroller. To ensure a Hodge situation would never happen again, both the treasurer and comptroller have to sign off on state expenses, called warrants.
We're getting two people in the mix in terms of money flowing out of the state treasury. And so the idea is to provide more oversight.
But as memory of the scandal faded, so did memory of why Illinois has two financial officers. It's faded so much that there's been almost perennial talk of merging the comptroller's office with the treasurer's. It would take an amendment to the state's constitution to get it done, but some claim it could save Illinois millions of dollars a year. Redfield seems game for it, but Mooney's a bit less optimistic. He says Illinois has a lot more to worry about than combining the state financial offices. Plus, those who believe in keeping the offices separate have history on their side. No one wants another Orville Hodge. I'm Sam Dunklaw.
You can find out more about the candidates for Comptroller and Treasurer and where they stand on the issues. That's all available at our website at statewideshow.com. Well, in this contentious political climate, many families are split on the issues. Some don't even agree on whether or not to vote in the first place. And that is the case for first-time voter Aaliyah Kissick. Rachel Odwell introduces us to her and her family.
Hey, ladies, how's it going?
Hey, how are you?
Doing great.
At 18 years old, Aaliyah Kissick is already a business owner. She's welcoming customers who peruse items in her boutique. She draws from her eclectic fashion sense to curate the secondhand items. What she doesn't sell, she donates.
My three values are self-confidence, sisterhood, and sustainability. So I feel like with the store, I'm really able to lift women up, have them come together to form a community, and then we can make a difference in the planet by like reducing our carbon tracks and all that fun, nerdy stuff.
Aaliyah is biracial and was adopted as a newborn by a single white mom. Her hometown of Athens, about a half hour from Springfield, has a population of about 2,000. The vast majority are white. Aaliyah says her family isn't very interested in politics, but she has bucked that trend. In third grade, she picked up on the energy around the 2008 presidential election, and the topic started coming up more in school. She's been increasingly fascinated ever since.
I was so excited about the 2016 elections. I remember I stayed up all night waiting to see who won. And I was so excited to see how it turned out and to see if my predictions came true, which they did.
Aaliyah calls herself a moderate. She's wary of publicly supporting candidates as she doesn't want to alienate opinionated customers. In the county where she lives, more than 65% of voters went for President Donald Trump. When she gets her ballot in this year's midterm election, the candidates for Illinois governor will be at the top. Aaliyah says this spring she started noticing political ads for governor ramp up.
Right around March, every time I opened YouTube, I would always see Bruce Rauner riding on his motorcycle. I didn't even really pay attention to the ad because I'm just like, what even is this? He was just riding his motorcycle and it would cut to him just speeding down the highway like he was some sort of cool kid.
Aaliyah says she's also not a fan of multi-billionaire businessman and Democratic nominee J.B. Pritzker choosing recreational marijuana as a focal point.
If you are assuming that people are only going to vote to get weed, you are underestimating the population. Like, yeah, some people might think weed is cool, but they also think more important issues like the economy or specific rights when it comes to being a citizen, protecting those. Those are more important than recreational marijuana.
As a business owner, are you inspired by seeing fellow business people running for higher office?
See, I actually think that it's a good thing. I mean, maybe not necessarily a bunch of multi-billionaires that have money in their family, but business owners, as a rule, are very good at being multifaceted. Business owners, especially if they are entrepreneurs and they start their business, wear all of the pants or skirts in their business. So they learn how to interact with people. They learn how to be diplomatic. They also learn how to manage money.
Aaliyah is pursuing a business degree. Today, she's in the commons of Lincoln Land Community College in Springfield studying. She says she'll continue to do her research ahead of November 6th, and lately, that has meant discovering the third-party candidates for governor.
there's not as much information online about them. The Republican and Democratic parties definitely saturate all forms of the media. So it's been a little bit of a challenge, but it's a challenge that I've enjoyed because I like the idea of the underdog and just giving them a chance. I love that. I think it's so cool.
Aaliyah says she'll stay open to hearing from all sides.
I definitely want the divisiveness to lessen over time. This is me being a little bit of an idealist, but I do hope that eventually the two-party system is eliminated. It's so divided, and with the advent of social media causing echo chambers, it's going to be even more divided.
As she weighs the best outcome for her future when it comes to candidates for governor, Aaliyah says all options remain on the table. I'm Rachel Otwell, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a regional journalism collaboration. The deadline to register to vote passed this week in more than a dozen states, but here in Illinois, you can still sign up to vote all the way through Election Day, as Mary Hansen explains.
You may have seen some social media posts saying Tuesday was the voter registration deadline in Illinois. But Matt Dietrich, a spokesman for the Illinois State Board of Elections, says don't worry.
There was no ending of the registration period on October 9th. It's just that that one method of registration ends.
Illinois residents can go online to fill out an application through October 21st. Just do a search for Illinois voter registration. You can also go to your county clerk's office to register anytime, even on Election Day. Dietrich warns if you register in person, you must vote at the same time, so be prepared to cast your ballot. Early voting locations are open across the state, and more than 29,000 people have already voted in person or by mail. I'm Mary Hansen.
Listening to Statewide, a Galesburg doctor became the patient when he suffered a dire medical emergency a couple of years ago, and he wondered why this happened to him. He came up with a plan to aid his recovery and help others, and Rich Egger has his story.
You took care of almost every child in our family.
This is typical of the greetings pediatrician B.S. Kesavan receives in the lobby of Cottage Hospital while selling and signing copies of his newly released memoir. The book's title is Healing the Mind with Faith, Friendship, and Love. He says all the proceeds are going to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital for pediatric cancer research and treatment. So many people showed up for the two-hour book signing that Kesavan ran out of books. He promised to get more copies, sign the books, and mail them to those who left empty-handed. Kesavan says his life story begins in India, where he grew up. He attended medical school there and became close friends with three classmates. They dubbed themselves the Gang of Four. They wanted to spread their wings after they finished medical school, so they moved to the U.S.
All the other kids wanted to stay there and be a little bit more safe. We wanted to fly, you know? So that's the reason, you know, because of the friendship and motivation and do something different, you know, with no fear.
And in keeping with the idea of having no fear, the four did not simply stick together when they came to the U.S. in the 1970s. They scattered to different parts of the country. Kesavan's path took him to Galesburg in 1976, and during the next four decades, he became a much-beloved pediatrician in the community. Ruth Ann Hanlon of Galesburg says Kesavan saved her youngest son's life. The boy developed spinal meningitis when he was just 10 days old.
We worried that he would have all kinds of cognitive disabilities, deafness, blindness.
But a quick diagnosis by Dr. Kesavan prevented any such problems from arising. Hanlon says her son is now 38 years old and 100% fine. Hanlon says Kesavan is not only a wonderful doctor, but he's a wonderful person.
He is kind and caring and thoughtful, and he made everybody feel like they were special to him. And, you know, that's a special trait in a doctor, especially a pediatrician. I couldn't raise my boys without him.
Hanlon bought three copies of the book, one for each of her boys. Kesavan says this is the first time he's tried writing a book. He says he did a lot of writing and reading when he was a child, but as he grew up, he became busy with medical school and later with his practice. Things changed when he faced his own health crisis. A stroke sidelined Kesavan a couple years ago, and he suddenly found himself with plenty of time as he worked to recover.
So I was just thinking, you know, what I should do. Then suddenly I thought, why don't I write my personal experience in the form of a book? You know, it's like a personal story. And this book is more very positive and kind of more telling people, you know, any kind of situation, you can always come up in your life and don't, you know, feel any fear, you know, and always having a faith, you know, faith in yourself and faith in God.
It sounds like you took something negative, the stroke, and turned it into a positive, the book.
Exactly, exactly. When I got sick, the first thing it happened to me, why me? Then I thought, why not?
So Kesavan committed himself to getting well and writing the book. He told his physical therapist he would get it done, and now it is done, nearly 2 years after the stroke. Kesavan says the book will give his grandchildren a chance to learn more about him. Based on the response at Cottage Hospital, plenty of other people are also interested in learning more about him.
Can I get a picture with you?
Kesavan says this was the first public signing event for his book.
Yes, I never did before in my life.
And dozens of people showed up. Were you expecting that?
That was a little surprise.
How do you feel seeing so many people show up?
I feel so happy to see them because they are my family. And always I feel they are my children, you know. When they come and smile at me, I'm really happy inside.
Kesavan retired from his practice last year, though he says he's feeling a lot better. He says he's 99% recovered just a couple years after the stroke. Kesavan says his book delivers three interconnected messages. Never give up, fear is the absence of faith, and friendship and love can help you overcome any difficult situation. He says his life is proof of that. Rich Egger reporting.
Just ahead, we'll take a closer look at an incident on a Springfield school bus. What really happened? That's ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Each week, we bring you reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you want to find any of our episodes, including this one, just head over to our website at statewideshow.com. And if you use the NPR One app, our weekly podcast is available there. On the way, we'll discuss climate change with the state climatologist. And later, we'll visit with a longtime Illinois farmer who tells us things on the farm now are a lot different than they used to be. But next on Statewide, every 2 years, Springfield teachers elect a union president. This year, that election was a squeaker. With close to 1,500 teachers voting, a new president was elected with a narrow 9-vote margin. There's no way to know how many of those teachers knew that less than a year earlier, the winner had appeared before the Springfield School Board to defend himself against allegations that he'd put a seventh grader in a chokehold. Our Education Desk reporter, Dusty Rhodes, has details.
Aaron Graves is a middle school teacher with 20 years of classroom experience. He also happens to be an officer in the Illinois National Guard. As the newly elected president of the Springfield Education Association, he holds a powerful position, representing teachers in negotiations and setting priorities for which issues get pressed or ignored. Graves campaigned with a clear agenda, listing, quote, safer and more orderly schools as his number one goal. In social media posts, he urged teachers to, quote, take back your loosely controlled schools, and lamented the lack of, quote, meaningful consequences for verbal and physically aggressive acts. But in June 2017, he appeared before the school board to protest the consequences of his own physical act.
I want it understood that although my actions as viewed by the district, seem egregious enough to dock me 5 weeks of pay and serve me a notice to remedy, a formal notice that I can be fired for any assumed misconduct in the future. I did not harm any student, nor neglect or abuse any student, nor have I ever.
The incident occurred on a school bus during the final few miles of a day-long field trip to a museum. Some students were rowdy and an alarm went off, signaling that someone had touched an emergency exit latch. Graves told me what happened next.
So the alarm goes off for the first time. Bus driver asked me to go back to check. I go back to the back of the bus. Can't figure it out.
This happened two or three times in quick succession.
At this point, the kids are becoming more chaotic. There's a group of boys in the middle of the bus that won't sit down. I asked them to sit down. All of them did, except for Isaiah.
Isaiah Evans was 12 years old at that time. We'll hear his version of this story shortly.
I asked Isaiah to sit down, and he wouldn't. So I tugged on his shirt right here and asked him to sit in his seat. And he says, you know, uses some expletives and get your expletive off me. So I asked him to go to the front of the bus. He wouldn't go to the front of the bus. So I reach in to assist him. And, you know, we get in a tussle.
He describes a complicated scenario that involves Isaiah resisting, then jumping and flailing before Graves managed to take control.
And I just pull him back two seats and set him in a seat.
Isaiah is 14 now and a freshman at Springfield High School. His body is bigger and his voice much deeper than it was when he went on this field trip in seventh grade. But here's his memory of this incident.
The alarm started going off and everyone was looking around trying to see who pulled it. And I stood up and I looked over the seat and I was like, who pulled the alarm? And then he came up from behind me and he grabbed my hoodie and pulled me on my seat. And I told him to get off of me, and I pushed him off of me. And then he told me to go to the front of the bus, and then he pushed me, and I stumbled. And then he put me in a headlock and dragged me to the back of the bus and threw me in the seat and was on top of me and was pushing on me.
Did you use any bad language in that scuffle?
I think I told him to get his ass off of me, yeah.
Obviously, the teacher and the student both tell this episode from their own perspective. More objective renditions can be found in handwritten statements collected from eight other students who were on the bus. Most of those accounts say Isaiah behaved disrespectfully by mimicking the bus driver, and each student mentioned that Isaiah used the word ass. But those same accounts say Mr. Graves, quote, picked Isaiah up by what seemed to be his collar, or, quote, yanked him up by his hood, or, quote, picked him up in a chokehold and threw him into a seat. Graves denies that.
There was no arm ever around his neck. So as I was pulling him out, and then when it went haywire, I used a CPI hold that, you know, I had one arm around his waist, and I had one, you know.
You're saying it was
like
up to
his shoulder like this.
Isaiah's mom, Daria Evans, isn't buying Graves' account. Not only has she seen the video of the incident recorded by the school bus security camera, but she also works with special needs teenagers.
They said that he was using CPI, crisis prevention intervention, but I've been trained in all that. And you do not put your hands on a student unless they are going to harm themselves or others. In CPI, they don't train you to put your arm around their neck. So I don't even see how that was justified.
Graves says he just did what was necessary to protect the safety of other students. But from his vantage point, sitting at the front of the bus, he could not know for sure which kid was the culprit.
But you assume the kid who is, you know, refusing to sit down, who's near one of the alarms, who's mocking the bus driver, you know, you just assume that this is the person who's setting off the alarm.
What do you think came over Mr. Graves? I mean, why do you think he did that?
I don't know, but I know, like, the whole trip, like, they kept on, like, looking for reasons for me and my cousin Javion, my friend Kusan, and DeMario. Like, they're trying to get us all in trouble.
Like when they stopped for lunch at McDonald's. A girl thought Isaiah and his friends were laughing at an unflattering Snapchat picture of her, which Isaiah denies, but Graves took the four boys outside and lined them up against the wall. Also, at some point earlier in the trip, Isaiah became boisterous on the bus, and Graves moved him briefly to sit at the front. So if students were misbehaving, why did Graves and the other teacher supervising the trip remain sitting together at the front of the bus?
I don't know. I could have been sitting at the back of the bus, I suppose. I don't think we were being neglectful by sitting in the front of the bus where you can turn around and see kids' behavior.
Here's the thing, though. If teachers had been sitting at the back of the bus, they might have realized that Isaiah had nothing to do with setting off the alarm. All parties agree the alarm was triggered by girls jumping across the aisle and bumping the bus's back door. In the minutes that elapsed between the scuffle and the time the bus pulled into Grant Middle School parking lot, Graves realized he needed to call Isaiah's parents.
So Aaron Graves got on the phone and he explained to me that he grabbed Isaiah by his clothes. He said, because he thought that Isaiah was setting off an alarm. That's what he said. He said, but it was a misunderstanding. I grabbed him by his clothes. I said, you did what?
Neither the school district nor the Springfield Police Department will release the school bus video, citing student privacy laws. SPD Detective Michael Flynn, who reviewed the bus video, wrote a report saying Graves, quote, overreacted and acted inappropriately, but the grand jury voted not to charge him with a crime. Still, Daria Evans says this incident traumatized Isaiah.
Well, his appetite decreased and he eats like a horse, but he kept waking me up saying he was having nightmares.
She got sleep medication and counseling for her son and physical therapy for his neck, and Isaiah elected to finish seventh grade at a different school.
I didn't feel comfortable at Grant, so I switched over to Franklin. It's a new school, a lot of new faces, but I made friends there after a while.
Meanwhile, as the case was being investigated, Graves said he contacted several media outlets seeking publicity for his plight as a teacher on extended paid leave. He doesn't believe he hurt Isaiah.
I've worked with a lot of kids for a lot of years, and I don't believe the actions that took place that day would have caused such trauma in a kid.
Graves ultimately lost just 3 days of pay. He is no longer directly involved with kids. Thanks to his new position as union president, he will spend at least the next 2 years working mainly with Springfield teachers. The other teacher on that field trip, Angie Manichetti, was elected vice president of the union. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
This week, judges, lawyers, and historians celebrated 200 years of Illinois justice. Michelle O'Neill reports the Illinois Supreme Court hosted a gala 200 years to the day the High Court was created.
Good morning, everyone. The first case on the call this morning is case number 122802, Gregg versus Rauner.
Legal proceedings like this one before the Illinois Supreme Court last month usually don't sound very exciting or even interesting. But 2 centuries of Illinois justice have obviously had a great impact on the state's institutions, society, and its people. Illinois Supreme Court Justice Tom Kilbride of Rock Island says at first members of the state's highest court were not elected by the people.
The Illinois General Assembly back in 1818 elected the first 4 Supreme Court justices, so it's not a true election by popular vote, but later on it was decided in the state of Illinois in the Constitution, and it's been reaffirmed in the Constitution. We have 4 constitutions in the history of the state of Illinois, and the one in 1970 that was adopted that we still operate under to this date mandates the election of judges in all instances.
As part of the state's bicentennial, the Supreme Court's Historic Preservation Commission created an exhibit about Illinois law. It teaches people about famous cases such as Block versus Chicago, the first movie censorship trial in the country, famous Illinois attorneys such as Abraham Lincoln, and to Kilbride's chagrin, an infamous sports scandal.
And as a White Sox fan, I hate to bring this up, but you know, the scandal in 1990 with the Sox, our legislature passed a law making it a felony to bribe an athlete to fix the score in a game, and likewise made it a felony for the individual to accept a bribe. And that was in 1920 as a result of the 1990. Now, some people say it's just that the Sox got caught and the Cubs might have done it as well, but I don't want to make all the Cubs fans mad at me.
The exhibit, called The Bicentennial of Illinois Law, is on display at the College of DuPage in Glen Ellyn. At the end of the month, it'll start a tour of other colleges and universities around the state. I'm Michelle O'Neill.
Case number 122802, Greg versus Rauner, will be taken under advisement as agenda number 15.
The Bicentennial Gala was held on Tuesday at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield. Cuts in the world's production of greenhouse gases need to happen sooner than expected. That's what the UN's panel on climate change told the world in a report this week. If the rate of global warming isn't slowed by 2030, it warns, the planet could start experiencing some dangerous weather extremes even more often. Sam Dunklaw got in touch with Jim Angel. He's Illinois state climatologist, to find out what the UN findings mean for industry, farms, and everyday residents here in the Prairie State.
Jim, what are your takeaways from the report? Is this anything different than what we've been saying for the last 20 or 30 years?
It's quite a report to look at and look at the kind of things that you have to consider for that. But I think it's a good exercise to do it. Even if we don't make it, at least kind of gives you an idea of the scale that we're going to have to undertake to make these kinds of changes. Because in the past, I know I've given talks like this, and other people have too. You know, we talk about climate change and what we can do to reduce our greenhouse gases. But, you know, a lot of it's we're just kind of polishing the rails on the Titanic. You really have to make some pretty substantial changes to make a big difference.
Is there any way for you to put that in context for us? What sort of stuff would we need to kind of tackle first, and what do you suppose would be most dramatic that needs to change that we're doing now?
Yeah, I think that probably some of the big things are change in how we produce energy. So I think most obviously you do a total switch to renewable energy and phase out all fossil fuels. So that'd be one. I think the other ones that would be impactful for Illinois is changes in agricultural practices. I know they've talked about, there's concern that we waste a lot of food, so it reduced the waste in food. And some of the things like meat production have a possibility of having higher carbon footprint than, say, a food-based diet. So there's even some arguments towards doing that. But also some manufacturing processes would have to change as well. And they're not only very big changes, but also they have to happen in a very short order.
I'm wondering if we can touch on what sort of evidence you've found of Illinois' climate change in your work as the state climatologist.
Most of my work is actually looking at changes in precipitation, and especially in heavy rainfall events. And that's where we're really seeing a strong signal and an increase in those really heavy rainfall events. And those are the ones that cause the flooding, the erosion, and all of the damages that we see across Illinois. In fact, I would say, maybe this is a biased opinion, but it's my opinion, is that that's probably the number one financial drain from climate change that we're seeing in Illinois right now. Temperature-wise, we are getting warmer, but it's not as dramatic as some other places. If you look at Alaska or the West Coast or our neighbors to the north, we've warmed some, but not nearly as much. We're getting more milder winters, fewer really cold days, and more of the warmer days. So we're seeing a shift in the spectrum there. But I'd say probably the heavy rainfall events is where we're seeing the biggest dollar loss, and also the higher risk for life lost as well.
I want to go back to the specific things that you mentioned that we would need to change, changing the way that we do agriculture, something that's particularly pertinent here in Illinois. From your perspective, is that possible? And I only ask that because a lot of folks seem to think, given how much money is dumped into keeping these practices just the way they are, is this an insurmountable goal from a policy perspective?
You know, in the last 24 hours, I've changed my mind about 10 times on that, my answer on that, going from being optimistic to pessimistic about how we would accomplish that. And it is a hard thing to imagine that we could do that big of a change in that a short order. I mean, we've had difficulty making even modest changes over the last 30 years. So to start talking about what we're going to do in the next 10 to 12 years, and making major changes. That's going to be tough. It's not impossible. Like I said, we've done that before, but usually it takes a national emergency kind of thing for that to happen. It's a pretty big, pretty tall order to fill as we move forward.
Jim, thanks again for the time and for speaking with me today.
Okay, you're welcome.
That's state climatologist Jim Angel. He talked with Sam Dunklaw. Up next on Statewide, getting into the renewable energy game. Back on Statewide, and still to come, we'll visit with a man who's been farming for more than 70 years. The changes he's seen, he'll tell us about them. That's on the way. State laws and grants have helped significantly cut the price of investing in eco-friendly energy in Illinois. So if you're a small business, a small college, or just a homeowner who wants to help, what options do you have to get into the alternative energy game? Peter Midland concludes our energy series.
In Oregon, Illinois, an old farmhouse just outside of town is a hotbed of alternative energy. It's primarily heated by wood, and they have a wind generator, although it's mainly used for educational purposes. Keep exploring, and you'll find a solar panel array sitting on top of the roof of a barn in front of the house, and a newer set on the other side of the yard with a small pasture nestled in the middle, usually home to a few animals.
We normally have alpacas in here, but I didn't let the girls out because there's one of them that's real pesty.
That's Bob Vogel. He lives here with his wife, Sonia, and for them, renewable energy is a way of life. They both taught environmental science for decades and got their doctorates at the University of Michigan, where they helped plan the first events that would become Earth Day. And they haven't slowed down post-retirement. They founded the Illinois Renewable Energy Association, they organize a renewable energy fair, and are an active part of other local environmental groups.
When we decided to retire, we said, okay, we need to do something. Well, why don't we just keep doing what we did? And we consider our retirement checks our checks for doing this free work that we've been doing for about 18 years now.
With all the energy that they get from their solar panels, Vogel says that from about May to October, they don't receive a single electric bill. They didn't start with that many, but kept adding on as the price of solar dropped and dropped over the past decade. But from a homeowner or small business perspective, he recommends that you start with energy efficiency if you haven't already.
After that, after you give consideration to the efficiency issue, then it's a good investment, a very good investment in solar at this time.
30 miles to the east in DeKalb, Whiskey Acres has taken that advice to heart. Whiskey Acres is a craft whiskey distillery run by Jamie Walter. It's located on his family's farm that they've been running for around 75 years, currently helmed by his father. A few months ago, they installed solar panels that now provide 100% of the electricity for both the farm and the distillery. According to Walter, it seemed like a natural fit.
I think you're going to see solar systems go up on farms all throughout the area because farmers truly are some of the first and foremost environmentalists. I mean, it's very important to our industry to take care of the land, the soil, the air.
They aren't the only craft distillery with a solar system, but Walter says theirs is one of the biggest in the United States.
Basically, there's 240 panels here of tier one panels. They're 355 watts apiece.
The sound of construction is everywhere at Whiskey Acres. They're adding a new building on the grounds, and along with that, they're looking to expand their solar panels and potentially use their land for a community solar project, which would add 10 or 20 times more panels. It would bring locally produced clean energy to those who don't have the space or the money for their own panels by purchasing a subscription from their energy provider. One of the other advantages of having such a new system is that Whiskey Acres has technology at their fingertips to keep track of how much energy is being produced or if the individual panels are working up to snuff, all from an iPad app.
Let me see if I can pull something up and I'll even share with you. So since the panels went live 7 weeks ago, to give you an idea, we have saved almost 20 tons of CO2 from power generation, or the equivalent of planting about 950 trees.
As you get closer to Chicago, North Central College in Naperville is also committing to sustainability. The 3,000-student liberal arts school supports several different alternative energy initiatives, including solar, solar thermal, and geothermal. This includes a humongous solar panel array on the roof of ResRec, one of the largest buildings on campus. It was partially funded by a grant from the city of Naperville. The building has 1,632 panels supplying around 22% of the building's electricity. And since it's at a college, it also demands strange peak energy times, says North Central College Sustainability Coordinator Brittany Drummond.
Actually, this building, the peak energy use of the building is at 9 p.m. when all the students are back in their dorms and studying away and using all their devices and everything.
Having this sort of installation at a college also affords unique opportunities for students to learn about alternative energy before they leave, and not just the environmental science students that you'd expect.
We had cost accounting students do a payback analysis for the project. We've had a PR class. They did a PR campaign when the solar panels were installed.
All of these projects have been spearheaded within the last 10 years, and North Central has plans to add even more solar installations on campus buildings in the near future. Back at the Vogel family ranch, Bob Vogel has hope for renewable energy in Illinois, especially with the passage of legislation like the Future Energy Jobs Act, which has made it easier for projects to secure funding.
This is an optimistic technology, that's why. And it's the research has driven down the costs, and they'll continue to drive down costs. So I think it's got a bright future, if I may use that terminology.
He also says it's helped spur opportunity for the average citizen or small business to invest in alternatives like solar and live a more sustainable, environmentally conscious lifestyle. I'm Peter Medlin.
There's been a lot of changes in agriculture throughout the decades, from the equipment used to the amount of land needed to sustain a livelihood. Jacqueline Driscoll learns more through the eyes of an Illinois man who's been doing it for more than 70 years.
It was a sunny day, warmer than usual for harvest, when I hopped in Gary Oxley's silver 98 model gleaner combine. The first thing I noticed were his hands, worn, aged by the sun, and his gold wedding band slipped down near his knuckle, unable to stay in the place where it used to sit as a young man. Gary is 87 years old, and he still sows and harvests seeds on the family farm in Modesto, a small village about 40 miles southwest of Springfield. He started as a teenager, helping his dad and grandpa.
That's all I'd ever done, really. Just kind of what I wanted to do, and so I just never had any idea of really doing anything else.
Gary has seen a lot of changes in this job over his 7 decades spent in the fields. In fact, he says, not much is the same.
In 41, my dad traded all the horses and horse-drawn equipment off to a Alice dealer for a tractor.
Alice Chalmers was a U.S. manufacturer that gained fame for their bright orange tractors and silver combines. The company is long gone. Sitting in an air-conditioned combine, Gary told me about harvesting crops in machinery that didn't have a cab.
Especially if the wind was just right, and the Alice Chalmers combines, a pull type, had canvases on them. One run this way, and the other picked it up and took it in. And that top one would throw grain right to your back of your neck a lot of times. Quite different than it is now.
Of course, today, it's almost rare to see a combine that harvests less than 8 rows at a time. Years ago, it might have taken weeks to harvest 100 acres. Today, that can be done in 8 hours. And a couple hundred acres with some livestock? That was a livelihood. But today, Gary says farming is starting to resemble a corporation. He's watched families sell off their ground because they just can't compete with the big guys.
I guess there's fewer farmers all the time anymore. It used to be a lot of them, though. You can see if you drive through the country where the houses have been and are gone now, you know.
In the past 5 years, farmers have suffered from declining market prices for grain. Gary, of course, remembers when they were much lower, but it was just a different time.
Last year, I believe corn was around $4 a bushel and beans 10. Now they've dropped quite a bit, but you look back in records years back, why, corn might have been $1.50 or so, beans $2 and something, but our input prices were much lower too, so that makes a difference.
He watched his father and grandfather build the farm from the ground up, gaining valuable life lessons along the way. He also credits the matriarch of the family, his wife of 61 years, Lila, who maintained a household while managing the books for the farm.
So you married your wife and you had a son and then you had a daughter and your wife stayed home and you farmed. Kind of sounds like the Midwestern dream.
Well, I've done pretty well, yeah.
Now he gets to see his son Doug and grandson Brandon take over.
Are you proud that you went into farming?
Yes, I am. I didn't go to college anymore. You don't get a job anywhere unless you went to college. I just like this type of life, living in the country.
Does it make you proud to see Doug and Brandon?
Yes, I do. Yeah, they're doing all right.
What do you hope for Doug and Brandon when you're gone?
Well, I hope they're able to continue, make a living at it.
I was still in high school when I put in my first wheat crop.
Gary's son Doug is happy to continue the legacy, giving his dad all the credit for his knowledge of farming.
Oh, just about everything takes a lot of hard work, and you got to bore down and get it done when it's time to, when hay's down, you got to make hay.
And Brandon, he says the same. He says his granddad taught him.
Value the hard day's work and what you can accomplish if you put your mind to it.
Maintaining the farm is and always will be a family affair, one the Oxleys are proud to be a part of. Around the noon hour, we said our goodbyes and I watched the Oxley men slide into Doug's 1973 Chevy pickup. They headed off to lunch at Doug's childhood home, where ham, mashed potatoes, and a vegetable waited for them, cooked by Lila, of course. These days, most farmers will get something fried at the local pub and eat quickly in the tractor. But Gary insists on a break and a hot meal, maybe a little old school, but a staple on the Oxley family farm. I'm Jacqueline Driscoll.
And staying on the farm, the American Mulefoot hog used to be one of the most popular pigs bred in the Midwest. Today it's one of the rarest breeds in the world. Just a few hundred are left. For Harvest Public Media, Shayla Farzan reports on how a small family farm in Illinois is trying to keep this hog from going extinct.
Josh Davis pulls a wagon loaded down with buckets of fermented grain. He leans over a fence and dumps the feed on the ground. A few seconds later, his herd of American Mulefoot hogs emerges from the trees.
They've got about 10 to 12 acres that they roam out on, but when they hear me do this with the bucket, they generally come running.
Davis and his wife Alicia have been raising the hogs on their organic farm in Pocahontas, Illinois, for about 3 years. The American Mulefoot hog doesn't look like your typical pink pig. It's jet black with a solid hoof, like a mule. It was a popular breed back in the early 1900s, with hundreds of herds spread out across 22 states, including Missouri, where it was nicknamed the Ozark hog. Today, there's only about 200 breeding animals left in the world. Jeanette Berenger with the Livestock Conservancy says the Mulefoot hog started falling out of fashion after World War II.
That's when commercial agriculture really started to take off, and the reason these breeds are rare in the first place is they just lost their jobs.
Berenger is working to bring back the American Mulefoot hog and other rare breeds. For some farmers, the problem is the bottom line. The hogs have smaller litter sizes and take about 2 months longer to mature compared to a commercial hog. But Berenger says they're worth the investment.
They're rough and tumble. They've got good survival instincts, and they're pretty easy going.
Back in Illinois, the Davises didn't need much convincing to get their own Mulefoot herd started. They liked the idea of helping to conserve a rare breed, and the taste of the meat was unlike anything they'd had before. But Alicia Davis says it hasn't been easy persuading their fellow farmers to take the risk.
We're still surrounded by very old farming techniques in this area, and they don't see why what we're doing may be important. You know, they think it maybe wastes time or money.
She says in the end, it comes down to economics. In order to keep the American Mulefoot hog from disappearing, they have to put it back on the dinner table.
It's very hard for people to think, how can you eat something that's about to disappear? Isn't that making it disappear? And that's the exact opposite. If people lose interest in this hog, that's why it'll go extinct.
In the past year, they've developed a small but loyal following of local chefs who buy their Mulefoot meat, including Rob Connolly, who owns Squatter's Cafe in St. Louis. He unwraps a frozen Mulefoot hog loin and points to the thick layer of fat encasing it. That fat and the flavor it brings is one reason why he's willing to pay a little more for the meat.
When I get commercial pork, oftentimes I don't like a funkiness or an earthiness that comes with it. This doesn't have that. It's rich. It's a clean flavor. It's such a special piece of meat.
Connolly uses the Mulefoot meat in just about everything, including a Mexican mole made with local pawpaw fruit. There aren't many Mulefoot left, and Connolly can't keep it on the menu all year round. When he does have the meat in stock, he tries to make the most of it.
There's not a single piece of that animal that goes to waste, whether it's the skin that gets turned into chicharron or the fat that gets used in a number of different items with the lard. Even the bones get roasted off to make a stock.
It's a start, but conservationists say it'll take many more chefs like Connolly serving American Mulefoot hog before the breed can make a comeback. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Shayba Farzan.
That will do it for Statewide this week. If you missed any part of our show or past shows, you can find them all at statewideshow.com. I'm Sean Crawford. Thanks for being with us, and join us again next time. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois public radio stations.